You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and if there's one part of the world that seems to consistently show the ability to shake up American politics, it's the Middle East. For most of my lifetime, anyway, the Middle East has had a role in shaping American views on foreign policy, relations with the state of Israel and the Arab states, and the tough issue of the Palestinian people. Once again, the Middle East is playing a major role in our nation's politics, and we're going to discuss this today with an old friend, Josh Krauschauer, who I had the chance to finally meet in person in February, which was nice. And he appeared several times on Heartland Politics when he was with the National Journal. You may remember him when he worked there. He's now the editor-in-chief with Jewish Insider, which covers politics and policy and the people driving it in the U.S., Middle East, and beyond. So who better to talk to about this? And I have to add, Josh hosted, as everybody knows, there's thousands of these podcasts out there right now. I thought Josh had one of the best I've heard, Against the Grain, and I really miss it. Josh, welcome. And is there a podcast responsibility in your future, I hope?
You know, thank you, Robin, for the warm introduction, and it's great to be back with you. I love doing that podcast, and there's got to be the reality is that being editor and being head of a publication takes so much out of your time. So it's really about finding the time but we should get it going and maybe we'll do something together at some point.
That sounds great. Well, I know we had a discussion when we met about politics, what's going on right now. It's really unsettled. But let's just start with, the role that this the events in the Middle East are playing right now in American politics. I was thinking about it preparing for the show. Is there any other issue in American politics right now that's causing as much long-term impact on the coalitions that the parties have?
So that's a great way to start the conversation. I wanted to kind of start big picture. And the rule of thumb I was always taught, based on all my years of reporting on the campaign trail, is that foreign policy never rates as a political issue, as a politically salient issue, unless the countries at war, like the Iraq War, under George W. Bush, Vietnam, but unless they're actually American lives on the line in a major war, usually foreign policy is just a no-go. I mean, it just doesn't register for good or for bad. It rarely comes up on the campaign trail. It's not just the Democrats, though. It's the Republicans going back to 2022, when it was striking to hear how many grassroots MAGA Republicans, to get a cheap applause line, would attack Ukraine, would go after our close ally against Russia. They were kind of aping the Tucker Carlson, which, by the way, also has anti-Semitic overtones, to put it mildly. So there's a lot of connections here. But the attacks against Zelensky, Ukraine, that came out of nowhere. I mean, that came very fast. The Republicans, by and large, supported the U.S. defense of Ukraine and the war for a number of months. And then something in the grassroots happened where Ukraine and opposition to Ukraine became something of a litmus test. And we forget about that because it almost now feels like ancient history. And I will say, there've been fits and starts, but Trump has actually governed in sort of a weird way that hasn't necessarily matched all of that hostile rhetoric from 2022, though he did obviously dress down, and J.D. Vance certainly dressed down Zelensky in the White House. But that's become a secondary issue. But I couldn't tell you how many times I was at CPAC or on the campaign trail covering Republican candidates. And if you were on the right, if you wanted to show your MAGA credentials, you were anti-Ukraine. You were anti-Zelensky. And it was very ugly, by the way, too, in much of the rhetoric. So what's going on in the Democratic Party? Again, foreign policy doesn't rate. Ukraine did. And you're seeing a similar dynamic now on the left in the Democratic Party. Obviously, Israel's war against Hamas after October 7th has been very, it's a war. I mean, the war is awful. I think throughout American history, when you're judging an ally who it's a democracy that, plays by certain rules, even if, when you look at our history in fighting wars, we fought some pretty, ugly ones ourselves. But I think most Americans generally had a sense of right and wrong. And when you see a terrorist group that's murdered Americans and or a country like Iran that has played such a evil role in that region, usually at least people know like where they stand. And what we're seeing, like we saw with the Republicans in Ukraine, we're seeing on the Democratic Party's left, a kind of a reframing of values and how people view the Middle East in the sense that people are actually on the far left are viewing Israel as the enemy and the terrorists as at best neutral and at worst somewhat a group to be sympathetic towards. So again, this happened pretty fast, and I think it's driven by the grassroots, it's driven by the podcasts, it's driven by younger online voters or Democratic activists. But it's a very similar dynamic to what we saw with the Republicans and Ukraine. Like, it came out of nowhere. I don't want to say it came out of nowhere. Obviously, there's a war going on, and there's a lot of images that are very, the collateral damage in Gaza and beyond has been very, damaging to Israel's image around the world and in the United States. And it certainly affected a lot of the Democratic Party's view of the Jewish state. But I mean, if you look at the comments and the podcast and just the commentary from the left, it's totally, it doesn't represent reality. And yet that's where the party has gone from being generally pro-Israel a few years ago to now almost universally hostile to Israel. And it's become a very salient issue. The biggest question left was like, is this a salient issue? In other words, are people voting on Israel? And look, I don't think maybe in many districts it may not be the case, but in these progressive urban districts, like we saw in New York City last week, and like we found this past week, the issue of Israel was a differentiating factor. We had a flip against the far left anti-Israel candidate. And in many of those races, it was the far left socialist anti-Israel candidate that prevailed. And that was in those deep blue districts, that was the main differentiator in those contests.
Yeah, and I want to get into the raw political impact, which is there, and I've been hearing a lot about lately in my circles. But I had on a guest, Fred Burton, not too long ago, who wrote a book on the 1983 Marine Barracks bombing in the Middle East, which Iran's fingerprints were all over. That book, I mean, again, for students of history, and I wonder how well history is taught anymore. But after reading that book, I was angry at what Iran has gotten away with. You know this, Josh. They were behind a lot of the IED attacks on our troops in the Iraq war. This is not something we're making up. This was directly attributable to Iran. My question is this. Did Trump kind of fumble? I mean, to me, there was a case to be made that I think could have appealed to more people based on the historical U.S.-Iran relations. Do you think he kind of fumbled that? Was there a better case to be made for going to war with Iran?
Oh, of course. I mean, this is sort of the reverse Midas touch with Trump, where he, it's interesting that Biden couldn't communicate as president, and he couldn't make the case for whatever position or policy, including support of Israel, when he was president. With Trump, is that he doesn't even want to make the case. Like, he certainly could, but I think everything he touches becomes so polarized and so partisan that I don't even know if it would help, to be honest with you, Robin. But there was no case made to come. I mean, look, there is a very compelling argument on why Iran is a bad actor and needed to be confronted, and they haven't, I actually think the nuclear program was set back quite significantly with the 2025 strike. That was much more of a one and done 12-day war. I think Trump, what did he say? They totally demolished the nuclear program. I mean, they set Iran back pretty considerably, and that's a pretty significant accomplishment, which Trump, I think, should have taken the win and pocketed some of that political capital. I don't think he had a plan for the war in Iran. I think he thought that there was a much better likelihood of regime change, and the Iranian regime was more vulnerable than it really was. And he doesn't have the patience, and he doesn't have the interest in, given the politics, to send American troops to finish the job. And I mean, I think you could get into an actual war, like a much more Iraq-like war, which Trump ran against and frankly doesn't have. I think when you look at Trump, he's weirdly hawkish in that he's willing to attack other countries and willing to raise the saber against enemies and allies alike, right? But he doesn't like putting, he's been very worried to put boots on the ground. And that's, I think, something that, in a weird, I mean, if you're going to go to war with a country and go to win, you have to actually go to war. I mean, I think there's a Iran has essentially called our bluff, understood that Trump doesn't have the political capital or the interest in actually, you know, sending troops into Iran. And maybe that's a good thing. I mean, I'm not passing judgment on that, but in a way, that's limited Trump's ability to win. And it's also, made him look very weak and sapped a lot of political capital. Well, I also think it was a bad pull. I mean, I said before the war, the February war began, that it was high risk, high reward. I thought, you know, there would be a lot of if look at the intelligence and look at the news reports as anyone else does. I mean, there was a sense that the Iranian regime was vulnerable after the war of the previous year and after the protests that took place. So look, if Iran's regime did collapse, it would have been a legacy item for Trump and it might have sealed his place in history. I mean, I do see the reward, and I know the Israelis certainly kind of painted that optimistic scenario when they briefed the administration. That's been documented in some contemporaneous reports. But boy, the political risk is what we're seeing now. I mean, that also could have been seen a mile away, that if you don't get that silver bullet, there's going to be a lot of costs, and it's an issue that is going to get polarized really quickly, and it's going to really affect the economy at home and affect some of the core coalition part or core voters that supported Trump in the 2024 election and turning away from him.
I think he thought it was going to be another Venezuela, and it didn't turn out that way.
And Venezuela was, I mean, by the way, like in a way that's a success in that we took out a pretty ugly dictator, but we still have a dictator. And speaking of communication, I'm not getting, and it's tragic, in the last week with the earthquakes in Venezuela, but we just don't hear from the White House about what's going on. I mean, there is a little bit of a cloud of, a lack of transparency. So I do think that in a way that was a success, but in a way we don't really know a lot about what's actually happening day to day in Venezuela.
You're listening to Heartline Politics on WBIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm Robin Johnson, your host, and I'm really pleased to have as my guest Josh Kroschauer, who's been on my show several times in the past when he was with the National Journal, and he did a great podcast, which I've already talked about. Now he's editor-in-chief for Jewish Insider. We're talking about the impact of foreign policy on American politics. As Josh explained, traditionally, foreign policy really hasn't been a big issue in American elections. It sure is now in this one, and you can make an argument. This is affordability, of course. Inflation is a big issue, but this one right now in the primaries is probably having a greater impact than that issue. I want to dive into the political aspect because that's what we both enjoy talking about. Let's look at the Republicans first. And you mentioned how Ukraine, that was interesting that I hadn't thought of in preparing. Ukraine really kind of split the Republican Party. Has the Iran war done the same? I know we'll talk about the Democrats in a minute, but what's been the impact on the Republican Party, the Iran war? Are they pretty much in lockstep with Trump's position?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's less the Iran war now, which is almost universally opposed by Democrats, except maybe John Fetterman in Pennsylvania. The reality now, and I think it's an uglier reality, is that it's translated into hostility towards Israel and relatedly hostility towards Jews. We're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism that's explicit in some of these candidacies in the Democratic Party. It reminds me a lot, if you want to make historical parallels with the other party, the lack of will in confronting a pretty illiberal and radical faction. There were a lot of legitimate issues, just like there are a lot of legitimate issues, I think, related to income inequality and, fear of war and foreign policy. There were legitimate issues at play here, but it so easily translates into an ugly populism that Trump certainly capitalized on in 2016. And now you're seeing the left and a lot of candidates coming out of the woodwork that are expressing, I think, some pretty ugly views, especially when it comes to Israel and Jews that have come out of the woodwork in the last few months.
Yeah. J.D. Vance, from what we understand, was skeptical about this war. There are others, you said, in the MAGA base who, opposed forever wars. That was one of the key planks Trump had. So you've had some dysfunction in the Republican coalition, but a lot more on the Democratic side. The big question is, and was I want you to talk about, Josh, the results in New York City. We're all aware several candidates, DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, were victorious. Their views are fairly radical, as you've talked about, regarding Israel and Jewish people. Let's just say that. The big question was that going to be transferable outside big cities and outside New York? Has that been answered yet?
No, it hasn't. Look, let's take it one step back. There were Mamdani's election in New York in 2025 opened sort of the woodwork for people who, candidly, like, he's not the first candidate to run on affordability. He's not the first candidate to run on, you know, freezing the rent. That is not new. What was new in New York City politics, especially, was his deep-seated hostility towards Israel. The fact that he would march in the Pakistani parade, but not the Israeli parade. That he could not, even though he condemned, I will say he has condemned anti-Semitism, but when it has anything to do with an anti-Semitism that relates to Israel or an anti-Zionism, he cannot bring himself, even when it's ugly and violent and it's become a real obvious issue for him. But that, his victory, the fact that you could win in New York City as a Democrat and not have to, you know, be, you know, kind of show the typical solicitousness of the Jewish community there, translated. There was a whole slew of candidates that emerged after that race that ran in congressional districts across the country. And at least in Democratic primaries, a number of them, not all of them, but a number of them have gotten through, have been successful. It's primarily in urban, you know, very liberal urban districts, Denver, New York City, Philadelphia. It's like the I-95 corridor now, Denver. but it's not just, you know, anyone who pays attention to politics knows Grant Plattner is the Senate nominee in Maine in one of the most closely watched Senate races in the country. He shares a lot of the same very radical anti-Israel views as Mamdani. And he also has a lot of other baggage when it comes to sexual misconduct, when it comes to, you know, misogynistic comments, racist comments in the past. It's a very different type of Democrat. And he's running in the biggest battleground Senate race in the country. So he's the nominee, and the Democrats overwhelmingly chose him, even though he was well, you know, the vulnerabilities he had were well documented. Michigan is a primary coming up in August, another big battleground state where Abdul El-Sayed, just as we're taping, had just got the endorsement of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and has been the darling of a lot of these same left-wing groups and candidates. So, look, I think the energy, I mean, I also think you can look at people, like, I like to look at the data beyond just the winners and losers. And John Hickenlooper, who is, you know, Robin, he's a Heartland and Rocky Mountain Heartland. I don't know, does Colorado count as a Heartland? But he's from, he was elected initially in a swing state, and it's now much bluer, but he was a popular governor. He's still a pretty popular moderate senator. No obvious vulnerabilities. He's not that, I mean, he's about 70 years old. He not only, you know, he won, but he only won with about 55% of the vote, which is really low for an incumbent senator. And he was running against a socialist, by the way. That's the key metric here. And he did about the same in the suburbs of Denver as he did in the city, right? I mean, there was obvious support for the socialist in the suburban Denver precincts as much as in the city. So I do think that, you know, it's kind of like the virus started in New York City. It's moved into other cities. And I think if you don't confront a virus, if you don't, deal with it, you know, it easily can kind of subsume the party. And I think we're seeing that spread. And you see Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, a number of other prominent Democratic leaders, just like Republicans with Trump back in 2015, 2016, being very wary about confronting this very radical faction because they don't want to be eaten alive by it themselves. So the big test, I'm being a little long-winded, but the big tests.
Oh, that's okay.
And in Maine, these are swings. Not urban. I mean, that's a much more broader and larger constituency. And it's also going to be in the general election. Like, you know, we know that Republicans have nominated some pretty crazy people from 2010, Sharon Angle and Christine, I Am Not a Witch, O'Donnell. And I remember in 2022, they lost a couple House seats because they nominated some pretty extreme candidates in swing districts. So this, the biggest test is going to be these battleground states, battleground districts, Michigan and Maine. Can Mike Rogers, if El Sayed is the nominee, will Mike Rogers then become the favorite? Is Susan Collins going to get reelected because of Graham Plattner? And that's going to tell you a lot about where the Democratic Party goes. If they lose the Senate because of people who are anti-Israel and tolerate at best anti-Semitism, you're gonna see a backlash, and they're gonna try to, you know, fight against these people in the run up to the 2028 presidential election. But if these guys win in Michigan and Maine in a blue wave, like, Katie bar the door.
Right. Right. I think the Michigan race is going to be the primary coming up. That's next month, I believe.
July, there's no break. Yeah, we got a break in July, and then August, there's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that Michigan Democratic Senate primary is going to be the key on this issue. And it's a three-way race. And I think that's going to be the telltale one. Well, I wanted to ask Josh, I mean, what you've been following this, you've been writing about this. I teach part-time. I have some of my students voice some views on this issue that concern me. Where are they getting this from? I mean, the younger people especially, is there, I'm always get suspicious in the era of social media that kids are going to sources that are taking them in a direction. And I'm not saying they're being naive or brainwashed, but it just seems like they're going in directions that seem at odds with previous generations. And I just wonder who's behind that, or any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, if I had time to write a book, the power of this phone and social media, and you look at the data, surveys of younger Gen Z voters, and how do they get their news? You know, our generations read a newspaper, watched cable news, which, you know, not always the best, most, you know, but there was a foundation of facts at the basis of most serious news publications. And that's how most Americans over the age of, say, 40 got their news. That's how they got information. We took that for granted. That was the ecosystem in which we grew up in. That's why I got into journalism. I read the sports page every morning in the Washington Post. And then I realized that was the gateway drug to the actual national news and the business news. And I got into politics that way, because I actually was immersed in factual information that was interesting. And I wanted to engage with the world in that way. That's not the case with just the reality. When you look at Gen Z media consumption, it's TikTok. Number one, a news source is TikTok. Information source is TikTok. Twitter, Facebook, any social media platform, their algorithms, and this is nothing new, we all know this by now, they incentivize extremism. They actually know they make more money when you're fighting with each other and you're spouting exotic opinions that people feel the need to counter. Trump did not emerge in a vacuum. People like to talk about economic populism and income inequality, and I'm sure those are all factors in kind of our political moment. But the reality is, our politics started going off the rail the second that social media, once social media platforms were ubiquitous on your smartphone, and especially the ones that, you know, were not, you know, TikToks of the world that require very little thinking, just passive consumption of the most content that's designed to outrage you. And that's what makes them money. You know, I'm shocked. There's a reason we have an FCC in the country. Like, I am not, you know, my instinct is not like regulate X, Y, and Z, but we're not even seeing like lawmakers shame like they've done before with the social media companies in other areas, shame them for their lack of civic responsibility in this space. They don't seem to care about like news information, offering a public, you know, any kind of civic larger responsibilities than making a quick buck. And I think it's having a dramatic effect, not just in how the young, the cliche always was like the young people are, it's the young people that are more liberal, that understand kind of classic American values, that are actually going to be our future. And you look at the polling of young Americans and what they think about core values and principles, like the tolerance of political violence is much higher among Gen Z than any other generation. And this is not just about policy. It's about like, how do you view the world? What are your basic values? And I think we're seeing that in our politics. Like, this is not a coincidence. This is no surprise to me that when you see those trends emerging year after year after year and getting worse, that's how you get candidates on all sides, left and right, that are more extreme and that have frankly, pretty exotic and out there views.
I just got time for one more question, Josh. I've only got a minute. This is unfair, but I got to ask this. A lot of people say if Netanyahu is off the scene, this might help. Do you think, let me frame the question this way. If he's voted out or removed from office, the corruption trial, all that, and a new leader comes in and makes, the peace deal with Iran is in place and just kind of moderates and gets this out of the headlines, do you think things will go back to normalcy or are they changed forever? American views towards Israel?
More the latter. It's less Netanyahu and it's more the fact that there are two extremist cabinet members in his coalition that play play pretty significant roles. Finance Minister Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, who essentially oversees the police, and it's become a real problem. Those two faces of the coalition government are pretty ugly faces, and it's certainly, it's not the only reason why. I don't even think it's the main reason why support has collapsed among Democrats towards Israel, but it certainly doesn't help, and it makes it uncomfortable, having to deal with those folks. So I do think, look, I think the first step is the Israelis electing a more moderate government that is attuned at the very least to American public opinion in a way that I think the mentality of the Netanyahu government, and I understand the short-term advantages is that we have a very strong ally in Trump that we talk closely with, we work closely with. He's very attuned to our policy and national security needs. Why, we don't really need to talk to the opposition, right? It's that's actually that. And as they're going more and more anti-Israel, why would we talk to the opposition? But not using those diplomatic muscles that they've really atrophied. And now that Trump has not been as close with Netanyahu since the Iran war has not gone as he hoped. You can see the problems that Israel's facing, not just with Democrats, which the support has collapsed, but even in pockets of the Republican Party. Trump, I think if you look at the polling, Republicans still are very solidly behind the state of Israel, and I think partisanship is actually probably going to keep them that way for a little while. But younger Republicans too are also showing the same on your social media and getting different views of the conflict than most people who kind of read the news and studied history, from generations past. So, that is a big red flag. I'm probably going over the time limit, but yeah, I think it would help to have a Bennett or I think what from the U.S. Jewish community, political point of view would be is Israel shouldn't be front and center in the news every day and everyone's feed, right? The thing that I always say is that I think that most American Jews who care about Israel would love for this to be sort of off the headlines. They don't want to make this the center of every news story, and it's become it's occupied an unhealthy space in so many Americans' minds. But I think what you're seeing now is that it's the far left that's trying to force this issue to everyone's feed.
We didn't even get a chance to talk. One other topic, I'll have to have you back on the AIPAC, which people hear the acronym AIPAC, American Israel Political Action Committee, which did become an issue up in the Chicago area and suburbs on their donations and primary campaigns. But we'll have you back, Josh, to talk about this. There's always going to be a lot to talk about. We'll see what happens in Michigan. And thank you so much again for being a guest today on Heartland Politics. Josh Krauschauer, Editor-in-Chief of Jewish Insider.
Thanks, Robin.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.